everyone. For the next two sessions, one before lunch and one after lunch, there are three breakout sessions, each of which will be repeated. So the idea, much like yesterday, is for you to choose two of those and to attend them. My name's Brett Sharps. I'm Associate Director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies here at BYU Law School and the professor at the law school. And it's my distinct privilege today to introduce my friend Mark Goldfeder, who is here from Emory University. There are a few law schools in the country that have centers devoted to the study of law and religion, and the Emory Center is the granddaddy of them all. It is, I think, if not the longest standing, at least the most developed in reputation and work of the centers devoted to law and religion studies. Mark is the head of the program there that focuses on teaching students about law and religion, religion and the rule of law. And so he is spends his professional life helping people who are not yet experts in the field of law and religion understand the basics. And for that reason, I think he is a really valuable asset for us in our setting here today. I was impressed, I don't know if anyone else was, with the number of hands that went up when the question was asked how many are not lawyers in this group. But I think it speaks to the saliency of the issues that bring us together, that it's a matter of interest and concern for all of us as citizens, and that these issues are too important to be left, as Alexander Dushku said, to the law professors, lawyers, and judges. So in addition, Mark has graduate degrees, LLM and PhD from Emory University, and is a specialist in Jewish law, as well as U.S. Constitutional law relating to law and religion. I want to thank him for being here and joining us, and ask you to join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I have, I think, the distinct privilege of having the longest commute to get here. I just flew in from Thailand yesterday and had the weird experience of flying 25 hours on one calendar day. So the point is, if any of you fall asleep, it's fine. If I fall asleep, just wake me up because I might be a little bit tired. By way of introduction, I want to take a minute and sort of lay out what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. But before we even start, I think it's important, especially because it was just July 4th weekend, it's important for us to acknowledge that for all of the hard cases about law and religion, and there are plenty, over 230 Supreme Court cases about the First Amendment alone in law and religion, for all those hard cases, it's important to remember that we live in a country that has unprecedented freedoms in law and religion in particular, and in many things generally, by many metrics, the greatest country ever founded. Before I teach law and religion, I always make sure to tell my students that we don't have a law and religion problem in the United States of America. No one is beheading anyone for what they do or don't believe, and it is really important, before we get all critical, because we're going to get all critical, to remember that we don't have that kind of problem here, okay? Hard cases at the margin don't mean that we don't live in a country that has, as its very First Amendment, respect for religion. Having acknowledged that, religion and state is really too broad of an issue for 1 hour. It's really too broad of an issue for one course. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to try to narrow our frame a little bit. Even if you just looked at the time that, you know, the Europeans got to America, what they were doing in places like James River or St. Augustine or Santa Fe, all the way to the Supreme Court last year with Obama and the faith-based initiatives, you would never finish. There's hundreds of issues to discuss. So we're going to limit it by cutting it down and focusing on federal constitutional issues primarily. What I mean by that is mostly the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Oh, thank you very much. Okay. Just got the clicker all done. Now, there's also a free speech clause, which is a rider to the religion clause sometimes. And then there's the 14th Amendment, right? The 14th Amendment, we're going to see, becomes incorporated. The First Amendment is incorporated through the 14th Amendment, which applies it to the states. We're going to narrow our focus initially. Hold on one sec. Okay. Initially, we're going to narrow our focus by looking at mostly federal constitutional aspects. We should probably take a step back, though, and highlight some of the different actors that we're going to look at. Did you? Hold on. Sorry about that.
Okay, now it's
right. We're good? Okay. There are three different sets of actors that we really want to take a look at. There are political authorities, religious authorities, and religious subjects. Political authorities are government officials, whether it's state, local, federal, anyone who has any kind of political authority. Religious authorities are people who carry religious power, much like it sounds. Anyone who's recognized as official by custom, ordination, or status, it could be a pope, it could be the rabbi, the imam, whatever religion it happens to be. Religious subjects are people who practice religion, and sometimes they do that in the community under a religious authority. In the United States of America, religious subjects are all voluntary. Nobody forces you to be part of any religion that you don't want to be a part of. Okay, those are our three aspects. And a lot of the questions that we're going to talk about revolve around the interplay between these different actors. So first of all, how does a church or a mosque or a synagogue or a temple, how do they run on a day-to-day basis? A lot of times they run under Christian canon law or under Jewish halakha or under any kind of religious law. And we're not going to talk about that because that's not really law and religion. That's religious law. And that's a completely separate field which has nothing to do with United States law. That's a big difference. The second thing we're not going to do is we're not going to discuss any of what I would call first-year law student subjects. See, a lot of times when a church buys property or commits a crime or a tort, it's just that. It's just a church or a mosque or a synagogue or any kind of religious organization functioning as any other kind of organization. For the most part, for the real majority of things, plain old procedure guides religious organizations as well, just like everybody else. When they file applications, they get processed. When they commit crimes, those are regular crimes. So we're not going to talk about the general aspects of law and religion where religious organizations and religious individuals function as just like any other organizations or any other private citizens. Sometimes, though, there are special things like intra-church disputes. Let's take a hypothetical. Okay, I'm from Atlanta. So let's say our first Church of Atlanta. Okay, our first Church of Atlanta is a beautiful, beautiful church. Okay, it's got the requisite ivy growing on the walls. It's hundreds of years old. Has millions of dollars of assets in the bank. A wonderful choir. Artwork, fill in the blanks, etc. But now they have a fight. Maybe it's over a doctrinal issue or a theological issue. Maybe it's over who they ordain. Maybe it's over the environment. Maybe it's over social welfare. Whatever it might be, the First Church of Atlanta is now disintegrating internally. They're no longer singing. They're now fighting in the pews. Okay? It's a problem. And guess what? One of the groups files an action with the Superior Court of the county. You know what the group says? What would you say if you were that group? They say, we're the real church, and there's a bunch of heretics in the church. Can you get them out? They ask for a writ of ejectment. They say, they're ruining our religious organization, and they're not following our religious law. Now you, sitting in your black bathrobe as the judge, are faced with a real dilemma. How are you supposed to know who is and who is not the real, quote-unquote, real First Church of Atlanta? What would you do? Any guesses?
There's no jurisdiction.
Well, they ask for a plain writ of ejectment. There are people ruining our church.
But it's a church dispute. The court has no authority to settle the church law.
Good. Any other?
Read the bylaws that organize the church.
Excellent. Neutral principles. Good. Anyone else? If two little kids are fighting, right, you might sometimes want to go to a higher authority. So what the court used to say was deference. Let's go ask the higher authority in the church. And the higher authority in the church will tell us what to do. That was until about 1979 when the court changed its mind and said, actually, neutral principles. You're exactly right. We don't have the ability to decide issues of church law, but we're not going to touch them. We're going to look at the neutral bylaws and treat this as if it was one of those other subjects we talked about, as if it was just any other organization asking for a writ of ejectment. Whoever has the majority, perhaps, whoever has first in, whatever the rule might be in the bylaw, that's what we're going to follow. Then the court changed its mind again and said, you know what, you can choose whether you want to use deference or you want to use neutral bylaws, which left things in a bit of a mess. And that's going to be sort of the theme going through this presentation. I'm going to warn you now, it's depressing. The state of law and religion in America is in a bit of a mess, and we're going to try to look for some principles, but I warn you that it's not always going to be pretty. Okay. The next thing we want to talk about is church autonomy, right? How much deference does the church have to do what they want to do? Can the church say to the priest or to the rabbi, can they say, well, let's take a hypothetical. I am a Jewish man, but I'm also fluent in Latin. And I would love to walk into a church of pick your denomination and perform any ceremonial mass that I'd like to. Can I? Is it discrimination if they say to me, well, actually, you're fully qualified, but you're Jewish, and so we don't want you? Does that seem like discrimination? Let's make it a little bit harder. I'm fully qualified, and I'm Catholic, but I'm a woman. Wow, now we're gender discriminating. Okay? I'm fully qualified, and I'm Catholic, but I'm gay. That's a touchy subject. What do you think? Should the church have the right? How much autonomy do we give religious authorities to make these kind of determinations?
Well, they have the right to select their own ministers and people who are going to perform their sacraments.
Okay, why?
Could you repeat the statement or...
Hypothetical? I'm sorry, is it... Oh, sorry, can you repeat?
Oh, I said they have the right to select their own ministers and those who perform their sacraments.
Okay, so you say we have the right to select our own minister, the ministerial exemption, the court calls. That's great. That's for a minister. What's a minister? Let's assume now it's not a church, it's a church school, and I teach math. Okay, but it's not... Go ahead.
Talking to the lawyer who advocated the Hobby Lobby case.
Really?
Hosanna Tabor.
Oh. Well, then you will definitely appreciate this. I was going to talk about Hosanna Tabor, but I can't anymore. What about the janitor? What about the once a month paper supplier from Dunder Mifflin? Does it have to be a religious paper supplier? Where do you draw that line on defining who a minister is and is not? A fourth area here would be the priest-penitent privilege, right? What happens when there's a communication between a religious authority and a religious subject, okay? That kind of stuff in general is not discoverable. You can't be forced to testify about it because those things are covered by the priest-penitent privilege. Is that constitutional? Isn't that giving a benefit to religion that other people don't have? Doesn't that seem a little bit unfair? Isn't that violating the Establishment Clause by giving preference to religion over non-religion? Or no, is that just an age-old thing we've always had, really since the days of ancient Egypt, and come on, why are you picking on religion? Let people talk to the ministers, it's an important part of their faith. You can always frame these issues in two different ways. That's some of the big issues. Next is the overlap of power, language, and authority directly between church and state. Maybe priests shouldn't be allowed to take part in the government. Maybe it's too much power for one person to have. If you notice, every single president that runs gives a statement about their religion and how they will or will not let any particular faith leader dictate what they are going or not going to do. Why do you think that's so? Because people worry. People worry about that overlap of power and overlap of authority, especially if the person is a member of a religion that's not so well understood, whether it was Catholic in the earlier in the 60s or whether it was Mormonism a couple of years ago. The candidates have to really talk about what they will or will not be dictated to by the ethics or by the morals of their faith. Okay, so there's concerns about overlap of power. Overlap of language, you know, we've seen that, we're all very well aware that we're living in a time where the world's going to look fundamentally different in a few years in terms of the family. But it's important to realize how that happened. You see, law unconsciously sometimes borrows a lot of language from religion. The civil laws of marriage till not too long ago assumed that marriage was a union, presumably forever, between one man and what. Where do you think law got that from? It got that from religion. And the pushback is people saying that's not fair. You can't impose your religious views on our understanding of what a union should look like. And whether or not there are benefits of having the same definition, they're willing to sacrifice those benefits on that altar of church-state separation. So there's also concerns about the power of shared language. Religious restrictions and accommodations versus the power to protect. We're going to go into that a little bit more because there are definitely some trump cards. And we'll talk about that in a second as we go on. So those are some things to highlight. We'll start with the free exercise clause, which is there really to find the balance between constitutionally grounded governmental power and free exercise and religious liberty claims. Here's some questions to bear in mind as we start. First of all, definition of religion. Can anyone define religion? Don't even bother. No one has been able to do it ever, at all, period. No one even tries anymore. Okay, that's kind of important. It's kind of a big deal. Federalism and neo-federalism, incorporation versus de-incorporation, national versus local standards. Do we want different states to have different standards of religious protection? What are the benefits of having those separate standards? What are the benefits of having one uniform law? Courts versus legislatures. Who should make the final decisions about religious exemptions? Who does a better job? Is it the legislature, especially a local legislature? Is it the court in a top-down decision? What about originalism versus interpretivism? Do you want to go with original intent or not? And it makes a really important difference about how you define religion, because once you define religion, you get all kinds of goodies, over 1,000 special exemptions that are given to religions and are not given to other people. So it really does. I'm not just waxing philosophical here for no reason. It makes a difference because there's money at stake. At the end of the day, that's what lawyers want. It also makes a difference because the government is now foreclosed. Once something is religion, you can't endorse it, perhaps, or you can't support it, or you can't house it or facilitate it in the same way, because the Establishment Clause says that once something is religious, the government needs to keep its hands away from it. So perhaps it would be really important and behoove us to try and think about what religion really is. When we talk about original intent, and this is something that I want to just clarify here, we talk about what was the original intent of the framers when they wrote these provisions. There's a lot of questions we have to ask. First of all, whose intent do we consider? Madison, right? The people who reported to us, the whole Congress, the whole generation. Where are you going to look for evidence of that intent? And how do you reconcile these clauses, each of which, when catched in absolute, contradict the other one? Right? A robust free exercise where everybody is allowed to practice their own religion might end up establishing a religion in some ways. It might end up moving us closer towards the establishment of religion. Whereas a robust establishment clause, which says you can't do religion in a lot of areas, might end up imposing upon somebody's free exercise rights. And so it's kind of odd if you think about it. There's a double barrel problem. If you look at religion from the free exercise perspective and try to make it as strong as possible, you will end up encroaching upon the establishment clause and vice versa. How did the religion clauses get formed? Well, too much to go into now all of the specifics, but if you look through the early state constitutions and if you look at the backgrounds of the people writing them, six main principles really come into play. Liberty of conscience, freedom of exercise or practice, religious pluralism or diversity, religious equality or non-discrimination of religion by the government, separation of church and state, and no establishment of religion. The main thing was Anglicanism as a common foil behind the scenes. They really didn't like England at this point in time, and their caricature of the English church set a lot in motion in terms of what they ended up establishing as the First Amendment. There were four different groups that primarily participated in putting these ideas forward, and each of them had slightly different takes on what exactly the six principles meant. And we'll just briefly mention them. There were the Puritans, the Evangelicals, Enlightened Libertarians, and the Civic Republicans, but all of them meshed together to form these 16 words and give us a First Amendment. Then they did something completely schizophrenic. They started establishing religion all over. They were prayer openings. They hired ministers to do those prayer openings. They gave Thanksgiving Day proclamations. They authorized the purchase of 20,000 copies of an American edition of the Bible. They appointed military chaplains. They gave conscientious objection rights. They gave conscientious objections to oath, tax exemptions for religious articles, and religious liberty guarantees for allies. Kind of looks like they forgot about the second half of the First Amendment. And again, these practices continue to this day. And so when you talk about religious intent, bear in mind that not every action they did was actually in conformity with their own, in theory, intent. And by the way, their Thanksgiving Day proclamations weren't things about turkeys. It was about the indispensable duty of all men to adore the superintending providence of the Almighty God. Right? Fairly religious in nature. Yes?
The Establishment Clause being viewed as a limit on federal power to establish a religion on all the states, but some would say that in the beginning it was meant to allow the states to continue to make their own proclamations and their own constitutions on what their state religion would be. And for up to 20 years after the Constitution was ratified, there were many states that still had a state-imposed religion.
Not that many, you're right, but we'll get to that when we talk about the exemption list. We're going to go through some free exercise stuff, and we're going to circle back to a statute, but it's a good point. Another thing to bear in mind is how we got these discussions. We didn't have a stenographer at these debates. These are the actual notes. We had one drunken reporter. He was literally drunk. And so that his notes before lunch are better. We have 3.5 pages of this. So if anyone ever makes the argument to you that we should talk about religious intent, this is literally what the notes look like. And it's important to bear in mind, you know, it sounds a lot better to say original intent until you see that. Oh, that's a sketch of Madison, by the way. That's real. Okay. What we do have, though, clean, are the drafts of the Federal Religion Clause. And I want you to notice, and I've helped you here by highlighting it in red, a word that appears in a lot of the drafts. What's that word? Conscience. A lot of the drafts. And then, oddly enough, it is conspicuously absent in the final drafts. Congress shall make no law establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And a few days later, we get Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, passed by the House and Senate. Where'd conscience go? It was all over. What's the difference between freedom of conscience and free exercise? Anyone? What's the difference between conscience and exercise? Yeah?
Does that have to do with, like, how you act on your conscience?
What do you mean?
Like, you're exercising public square versus private worship or something like that.
Good, elaborate on that.
So, like, your freedom of conscience allows you to pray in your bedroom, but it doesn't allow you to pray at a city hall meeting.
Good, when I talk about the dictates of my conscience, where is my conscience? In my head, exactly. It's entirely internal. It's the right to think what I want to think. Yes?
I would argue that it's external. It's,
go ahead.
An external sense of right and wrong.
That you act upon?
Yeah, you act upon, certainly.
Okay, good. Bear that in mind. Anyone else? Well, let's look at the... go ahead.
I don't see how you can establish a conscience.
Great. Well, that leads to the next point. Why is conscience out of the final draft? One answer is, of course, you can think what you want to think. Is that what you're saying? Of course, yeah. You can think. You don't need that. There are some rights that are morally inalienable, right? You can only take them away if there's a good reason. Then there are some rights that are really inalienable. You can't take them away. Like what you think in your own head, that's your actually inalienable right. Nobody can take that away from you. Period. And you can't regulate it either. So maybe they took out conscience because they realized, gosh, this is a bit silly. We don't need to give people the right to think what they want to think in their head. What's another reason, though, why they might have taken it out? That's one possibility. Yeah?
I think
okay, good. Good. Yeah.
Perhaps along those same lines, it's the fact that people could say that you can't tell what somebody's conscience is, so people could claim something is their conscience that is really contrary to what the government could allow.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. Are we being too lawyerly about this? Is it possible that free exercise and freedom of conscience are literally just the same thing? Let's raise that as a certain possibility, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly where we're headed. Let's skip right there. Okay. So, again, the first part, free exercise of religion, leaves us with more questions, really, than answers. What does prohibit mean? Does it mean to abridge, infringe, to regulate? What does exercise mean? Does it include things like press, assembly, speech, liberty of conscience? If it includes press, assembly, and speech, why do we need it? It must include something more, because we have those rights already. Okay, does it include What does free exercise mean? Does it mean you literally are free, you can't tax it? Or does it mean that you get exemptions? What does religion mean? We don't even know. Why only Congress? Why only Congress in the initial draft? Okay? And shall make. What if, can they ratify things that were already made if they already established things? Okay, a lot of questions that the first drafts lead us with. Now, eventually, we're going to incorporate it into the states. I mean, incorporated for a lot of reasons. We've just seen what can happen across the ocean in World War II when there's not enough protection, and the New Deal wants us to consolidate things against this new enemy in the Cold War. There's also a lot of universal human rights talk going on at this time. So we decide to apply it to the states through the 14th Amendment. There are some drawbacks, though. And that if you've ever visited the South, you know that states are different. Okay, states really are different. And perhaps if everyone in X state wants something, why can't X state have a different rule than Y state? Why is it fair that everybody has to have the exact same rule? Or for that matter, if 99% of people in X state want something, why should there be a tyranny of the minority? Why should 1% be allowed to say, hey, no, you can't do that. It violates my First Amendment rights. Now, the answers to those questions are, perhaps, well, would you want your rights to change based on which exit you took off the highway? Oh, God, I meant to go to New Jersey. I have no rights here. I better get back on the freeway and go to New York. And also, who was the First Amendment put in place to protect in the first place? If it was to protect the majority, you wouldn't need it because they would win on the votes. It's obviously put in place to protect the minority. It is literally specifically for that 1% of people in X state. Otherwise, we wouldn't need a First Amendment. Now, I'll point out that there are some trump cards in First Amendment jurisprudence. Again, the conflicts in free exercise are the power of the people guaranteed in the Free Exercise Clause versus the governmental power or a delegated power. But if it's a criminal law versus the free exercise rights of an individual, whether it's polygamy, sacramental wine, peyote, medical care for children, corporal punishment, child labor laws, the government always wins. That's your bar exam rule. The government has certain core powers, okay, and certain core functions, including protecting the safety and security of its citizens, and they're not going to let you get around that, and that's very important for debates that are happening today, which we'll get to at the end, but there was a question.
Well, I was just going to comment that I think that the Constitution and its amendments are also meant to protect the people from the government.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The majority needs protection as well.
Okay, fair enough.
The government always wins because of compelling government interest.
It's not always framed that way. Eventually in 63 it'll get framed that way, but even so it's considered just a core aspect. And the government sometimes in early cases will talk about core and tangential aspects of religion and core and tangential aspects of governmental power. And when it's weighing different things, the core aspects of the government win. Interestingly enough, taxes also get a lot of that treatment because at the end of the day everybody likes money and the government doesn't want to lose money. There are standards of review that we go through over the course of the time. We're going to run through them very quickly. Rational basis review begins in 1879 with the Reynolds v. United States. And for rational basis review, all the government has to say is that there's a legitimate interest in doing what they want to do and that it's rationally linked to how they're doing it, which means that you're going to lose because if you can come up with any excuse, the government can come up with any excuse that they want and that's going to be okay. We're going to see in a minute how it flips to intermediate scrutiny in 1940 and then to strict scrutiny in 1963. Eventually in 1990, which is the standard till today, it's going to flip sort of back to rational basis, and we're going to uncover all this in the next few minutes. But let's start with Reynolds, the first free exercise case. Let's read some of the language from Reynolds. Reynolds is a case about, anyone?
Polygamy.
Polygamy, yep. This is what the court says. Polygamy has always been odious among the northern and western nations of Europe, and until the establishment of the Mormon Church was almost exclusively a feature of the life of the Asiatic and African peoples. Okay, first of all, courts don't talk like this anymore. This is not okay. And whenever I ask my students to read this case, I ask their impression. Most of them don't talk about that, but they should. This is not okay language for a court to use. Listen to the next. Suppose one believed that human sacrifices were a necessary part of, that's not an okay analogy, were a necessary part of religious worship. Would it be seriously contended that the civil government under which he lived could not interfere to prevent a sacrifice? Or if a wife religiously believed it was her duty to burn herself on the funeral pile of her dead husband, would it be beyond the power of the civil government to prevent her from carrying belief into practice? Not the same thing as polygamy, okay? Really, truly not. And it's important because Reynolds is going to be revisited again soon. Nowadays it is string-cited and people don't actually read it. It's a terrible opinion. Let's look at some of the bases.
I'm not clear on why polygamy is not analogous to those.
To burning people on a funeral pile?
Yeah, to a person choosing to burn herself on a funeral pile.
We'll get to it. Absolutely. That will end on that, because that's a good one. Okay? Here are the arguments. No, it's a good question. Here are the, there are no stupid questions, and that was not a stupid question at all. And it, by the way, there are plenty of people who would argue even today that it is the same thing. So I'm glad that you raised it, and time willing, we'll definitely get to it. The arguments in Reynolds, again, important because it will be revisited soon. First is the argument from history. That's not what marriage is. Is that going to fly today? No, it's not. Utility, well, there's a slippery slope. If you allow this, what's next? Courts aren't buying that anymore. Really, not at all. Okay, well, there's an argument from the nature of religion itself. What does the free exercise protect? And the court here says, the free exercise only protects conscience, the things inside your head. Obviously, it doesn't protect actions, the court says. No, no, no. That is not okay. And what's so weird is that, first of all, aside from the fact that you just saw, conscience is not in the actual text where exercise is. It quotes Madison, but it doesn't finish the sentence. It quotes and says, religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator, is the definition of Madison, whereas what Madison actually said was, religion is the duty we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it. They literally cut his sentence in half to make it seem like he was only trying to protect conscience. Okay, now I asked you before, why is conscience out and exercise in? And the court here plays dumb and says, it's not, you messed up. Exercise means conscience, and both of them are only trying to protect beliefs, not actions. The exercise clause protects only beliefs, not actions. Beliefs are private, and you have liberty of conscience to believe whatever you want, but the moment you exercise those beliefs, you invariably have to be subject to other people's rights to enjoy life, liberty, and property, and you're subject to governmental regulations that protect those other rights as well as the health, safety, and welfare of the community. When you practice, exercise, or manifest your faith in public acts, you subject yourself to possible regulation by the state. Now, that's a severe limitation on what free exercise protects. Free exercise only protects what you're thinking in your head. Thankfully, that doesn't last very long. In Campbell v. Connecticut in 1940, the case is about whether or not witnesses are allowed to proselytize. Is it a protected right? If so, can the government regulate it? If so, on what grounds and what form? And the central issue, again, was what does free exercise protect? And there's a magic act in Campbell. It does two very important things without making a big fuss about it. First, it incorporates, as we said, it incorporates the First Amendment to the states through the 14th Amendment. And second of all, it says the amendment embraces two concepts, freedom to believe and freedom to act. The first is absolute. Freedom to believe, obviously. But in the nature of things, the second cannot be absolute. That's fair. It's a lot more fair. And conduct remains subject to regulation for the protection of society. So goodbye, Reynolds, just like that. Pretends it never happened. Of course, the court says it protects acts because you don't need to protect what's in your head. Now, you can, obviously, you can regulate it, okay? You can regulate what you're going to do, and so they introduce the idea of intermediate scrutiny. You need to have a significant or important state interest in order to regulate somebody's religious practice. There needs to be a substantial relation between that stated interest and the regulation you've chosen. There can be no religious discrimination on the face of the statute and no religious discrimination in application of the statute. I always tell my students, if you ever fail a prong C, you need to turn in your license. Because if you, as a lawyer, are dumb enough to write, and I'm putting this law in place because I don't like your religion, right, with discrimination on the face of the statute, forget a citizen, you don't deserve to be a lawyer for sure. Okay. So we've abandoned the belief act distinction, right, for prima facie free exercise questions. But it does recognize other distinctions. Now, Printy, Massachusetts is a great case. I want to talk about it for a second because it really gives you a sense of how you can frame a particular issue, which is so important in telling the story of law and religion. The case is about an aunt who takes her young niece out at night to deliver religious pamphlets with her, right? The niece begged to come, and finally auntie said, okay. Now, you can frame this case as child labor law, right, because they were distributing pamphlets and getting money back, and they're working at night and off hours. What a horrible, disgusting aunt this was, making her child work late at night. Or the aunt had legal custody of the child. It was basically her child, and she was bringing the child to her place of worship. It was her place of worship to distribute leaflets. That's what she did to worship, and all she was doing was training her child. We've all brought our children to church or synagogue. It's totally normal, but how you tell the story to the court makes a huge difference. Are they going to a place of worship, or is she putting this child into the stream of commerce in the middle of the night? the court says, well, it's a violation of child labor law. Protecting children, legitimate state interest. It's an important relation. Yeah, we don't want children on the street at night. There's no facial discrimination, and there's no discrimination as applied. The laws are enforced against everyone. But the court says something important, which is, why don't you go to the legislature and ask them for an exception? The court says, listen, we're going to follow the law here. We think it's unfortunately, you're not going to be allowed to do this, but why don't you go and talk to your local legislature and get them to amend this? And that's important because it starts the balancing act of who does a better job. Courts sometimes try and defer to legislatures who try to defer back. As we'll see in the 90s, sometimes they both try to take control. For the next several years, the case law develops much along those lines with one important footnote, literally, which is footnote 11 in Torcaso v. Watkins, which says that among religions in this country which do not teach what would generally be considered a belief in the existence of God are Buddhism, Taoism, ethical culture, secular humanism, and others. It explodes the definition of religion, right? Secular humanism is now religion under U.S. law, okay? So Torcaso v. Watkins, footnote 11, really explodes our definition of religion. But what's happening is, and there are four cases before this that really get the court wondering about what it's doing, is people are losing, especially in Sunday blue laws, people are losing who the court feels like should be winning. They feel like they really should be getting this exception. Intermediate scrutiny is not doing a good enough job. And law and religion protection in the courts is sort of like a pendulum. It swings all the way back and forth. And now we're swinging to the top of protection, and we have Sherbert v. Verner. And the court says, you know what? We're introducing a new standard, a heightened, stricter scrutiny. The government can only restrict your religion if it's in pursuit of a compelling or overriding state interest, a stronger language, and has to find the least restrictive alternative for achieving that interest. If there's another way to do it without restricting your interest, the government can't do it. Still no facial discrimination and still no religious discrimination in application. Okay, so the pendulum has swung all the way to the top. Now I want to pause for a second. There are tons of cases that we could be covering. In the course I teach, we usually cover about 77 cases. I'm giving you one line, one brief reading that's sort of an introduction of how you might want to think about it. So the court swings all the way towards protection in Sherbert v. Verner, and then guess what? It starts swinging back because people start winning who the court's not sure should be winning. Thomas, you're you board. You have a witness in a steel mill. It doesn't want to participate in making the turrets because the turrets might then go on a tank, and the tank might then go to war, and the tank in war might then kill somebody. And he says, this is against my religious belief. And the court actually interviews other witnesses who say, no, that's not part of our belief system. That's okay. That's tangential and far enough removed that it wouldn't actually be a violation. But he says, no, this is my idiosyncratic belief. I think it's a violation under God. And the court says, well, you know what? Idiosyncratic beliefs need to be respected. Okay, that's a pretty broad understanding that even if it's not an established religion, if it's your idiosyncratic belief, you can get federal protection. That's interesting. What about if it's a brand new thing? So you just got a new job, and your job requires you to work on Saturday. And the day after you got the job, you decided to convert to a religion that says you don't have to work on Saturday, or Sunday, or Tuesday, okay? That's what happens. Jewelry store in Florida, employee converts. Now she's a brand new Seventh-day Adventist. Now most of their money is made on Saturday, because people have off on Saturday. They can go shopping at the jewelry store. She says, sorry, I can't come in. Court says, you know what? New believers, they're very zealous about their faith. They get the same protection as long-standing members. So now you can have an idiosyncratic new belief, right? You woke up one day and decided that from now on, my religion says I can't work on Tuesday and Thursday and Sunday and Friday and from 9 to 4 on Wednesday, right? And perhaps you're going to win. Now, Frazee v. Illinois is almost a test case. The guy has no organized church, no dogma, but he thinks it's a transcendent good not to work on Tuesday. And he wins. He wins. And the justices reject the specific claim that was made, which is, excuse me, people are going to say they religiously have to watch football. This is ridiculous. Too many people are winning. And the pendulum now, at the height of its swing, swings back. And it swings all the way back to rational basis. It swings all the way back in a case called Employment Division v. Smith. The court considered the claims of two drug rehabilitation counselors. They were fired because they ingested peyote during a Native American church ceremony. And the court said, you know what? Instead of the strict scrutiny test, if there's a law that's neutral and generally applicable, doesn't single out religion, it's not facially discriminatory or an application, forget everything else, it's fine. Otherwise, we would create a system in which each conscience is a law unto itself. It's a slippery slope argument. If we start letting people have exemptions like Frazee or like Thomas, then eventually everyone's going to create their own law and we're not going to be able to survive as a country. The media did not like this. Nobody really liked it. And so Congress passed RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in November of 1993. Now, by the way, I want to just point out to you that if, and this is important, Church of the Kumu Babalua v. City of Hialeah, which is the best named case ever, but also important because it establishes the rule that even under Smith review, if something is in fact not generally applicable and neutral, right here, the church itself was targeted. Everybody else got an exemption except the church. Then you would still get strict scrutiny, okay? If it's really not a generally applicable law, then you would still get strict scrutiny. But Congress passes RFRA by a unanimous House vote and a near unanimous Senate vote, 98-2, explicitly intended to overturn Smith and go back to Sherbert v. Verner. The text of RFRA itself refers to Smith, and it notes that in Employment Division v. Smith, the court virtually eliminated the requirement that the government justify burdens on religious exercise imposed by laws neutral toward religion. And RFRA reinstituted the more protective, compelling interest standard that had been the law since 1963. It has to be in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest, least restrictive means of furthering that governmental interest. And what happened is schoolyard fight between Congress and the court. The court had just struck down Sherbert and put in place Smith. Now, Congress went ahead and said to the court, no, we're putting Smith back. Well, the court says, no, you're not. We're putting Smith back. The court strikes down RFRA for state and local governments and said that Congress overstepped their bounds. Congress can do that for federal laws, but they can't do it for state laws. They don't have that kind of power. Okay. They will apply it to federal governments, right? But they will not apply it to state law. So now you have a power struggle between who gets to define federal law and religion, Congress or the courts. Congress responds and they pass RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Persons Act, and said, fine, we'll be more specific about our powers. It won't apply to all federal laws, but will apply to zoning issues and people who are imprisoned. And finally, states have said, well, in this vacuum, we don't want to have Smith review, which is rational. We're going to pass our own versions of state RFRAs. 21 states have passed their own RFRAs, and several others have interpreted their own state constitutions under Sherbert standards. Our current system is, as I said in the beginning, a bit messy. So if you have free exercise law independent of any statute, then you get Smith review of generally applicable neutral laws. It's better to plead a specific statute than a simple free exercise clause. If you plead a statute, then you get RFRA. If you can spin it as free speech, you might at least get intermediate scrutiny, which is ironic that free speech protects religion more than the free exercise clause protects religion. If you can fall under RFRA, a federal statute, or RLUIPA, land use or prisoners' rights, then you get strict scrutiny. If you're a state, you can do your own thing. So oddly enough, the worst thing you can do to protect federal free exercise is to argue under the First Amendment. Odd? I think so. Which, by the way, leaves us with essentially the answer to our earlier question. We do have different standards depending on where you get off on the highway, because one state might allow a certain practice while another state might not allow it. So, for example, a landlord, for religious reasons, refuses to rent her apartment unit to an unmarried man and woman. Is this housing discrimination? Depends what state you're in. Depends if they've adopted a RFRA. Even if they have adopted a RFRA, it depends how they interpret compelling interests and narrowly tailored, whether there's a compelling interest to avoid that kind of discrimination or not. So it really does matter where you get off the highway. You might, in fact, have different rights. Hold on to that thought. We're going to go back to the Establishment Clause for a minute, and then we'll bring you back here. We're going to spend less time on the Establishment Clause because there's really no Establishment Clause jurisprudence. It's that bad. It's horrible. And I'm sure many people will disagree. I'll explain to you very briefly why I think it's truly terrible, and I'll let the justices speak for themselves when they talk about the main tests that we quote-unquote use in Establishment Clause jurisprudence. What is establishment? Well, we have Anglicanism as a foil, so at the very least, you can't establish a state religion. Fine. But does it mean no official state religion or anything that moves us towards having a state religion? What does the exact text say? Respecting an establishment of religion. How do you respect an establishment of religion? Anyone? It's kind of a hard word there, respecting. Does it mean in reference to? Does it mean showing it some sort of favoritism, moving in that direction, a nod in that direction? The court goes through several different tests. Two main approaches emerge, separationism and accommodationism. Separationism says we need to have a high wall. Everything needs to be segregated. Evangelical side says we want to protect religion from politics. The Enlightenment side want to protect politics from religion. They both say that good fences make good neighbors, and it tends to attract the left wing of the court, but it's not just secularists. There's a very religious argument here as well. As Madison wrote, a true religion doesn't need the support of law. Accommodationism is a little bit more friendly at first towards religion, which is why can't government accept religion? Let everybody just smile and get over it. Of course, one religion can't be favored, and religion can't be favored over non-religion, of course, but why would you give every soup kitchen money except for the religious one? That almost looks like you're hostile towards religion. Let everybody wear what they want to wear. Let the kid wear a head covering or a cross. Why can't you have a Christmas tree? Let everyone put their symbols where they want to. The problem is that once you do those things, you open yourself up to letting everybody in, and people don't like that. So Florida, for instance, has always been a very accommodationist state, and they started to let groups distribute Bibles near the schools before school hours. And the response was the Satanic Temple started distributing the Satanic Children's Book of Big Activities. True. And Florida said, well, listen, he wanted us to be an accommodationist state. We have to accommodate. And they're free to distribute this literature as well. That happened. Florida has had a history. They do not deal well with this kind of stuff. Anyone know what that is?
Beer cans.
It is beer cans, but what's it forming? Anyone watch Seinfeld?
Festivus.
Exactly. The state capitol in Florida, very accommodationist, allows you to put up religious symbols. However, once you allow people to put up religious symbols, they're all allowed to be up, including a Festivus pole from Seinfeld made of rusty beer cans. It is literally right in front of the nativity scene, because that's what happens sometimes with accommodationism. Okay, getting back to our establishment line, Everson v. Board is what really starts us off. It incorporates the Establishment Clause through the Due Process Clause, and it defines the Establishment Clause, but what it really does, it's a case about New Jersey private school kids getting reimbursed for taking public transportation, right? School bus case. And the court basically says, listen, everyone is entitled to neutral forms of aid, right? Everyone's entitled for policemen and firemen to come help the school, even if it's a religious school. This is the same thing. This is a neutral form of aid. It's just a bus. The question, though, is when does that bus become more than a bus, right? What if I'm paying for secular books inside of a religious school, or for a teacher to teach a secular subject inside of a religious school? The question is, what is furthering religion and what's only tangentially related? And the court spends years trying to decide that question, and it fails gloriously. You'll see why I say fails gloriously. Lemon, which is the famous Lemon test, was the Non-Public Elementary and Secondary Education Act allowed the state to reimburse non-public schools, including religious schools, for the salaries of teachers who taught secular material in non-public schools. Secular textbooks, secular instructional materials, right? This is just like a bus, just a secular thing that happens to take place in a religious context. And the court says, well, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to have a three-prong test. The law has to have a secular purpose, has to have a primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion, and it can make no excessive entanglement of the government in religion. The problem is all of those things are so vague that they do literally nothing. Here's how Scalia describes the Lemon Test, like some ghoul in a late night horror movie. This wise aid failed gloriously, that repeatedly sits up in its grave and shuffles abroad after being repeatedly killed and buried. Lemon stalks our Establishment Clause jurisprudence once again, frightening the little children and school attorneys of Centrum Reaches. Its most recent burial, only last term, to be sure, was not fully 6 feet under. Over the years, however, no fewer than five of the currently sitting justices have, in their own opinions, personally driven pencils through the creature's heart. And a sixth has joined an opinion doing so. The secret of the Lemon's Test survival, I think, is that it's so easy to kill. It's there to scare us and our audience when we wish it to do so, but we can command it to return to the tomb at will. I think this is a real opinion. When we wish to strike down a practice forbids, we invoke it. When we wish to uphold the practice forbids, we ignore it entirely. Sometimes we take a middle course, calling the three prongs no more than helpful signposts. Such a docile and useful monster is worth keeping around, at least in a somnolent state. One never knows when one might need him. Okay, Kennedy put it better, but not as poetically. It is flawed in fundamentals and unworkable in practice. The court basically decides what it wants to do and then finds a way to justify it under Lemon. So how do you actually argue an Establishment Clause case? You don't do it under the Establishment Clause. Similar to what we talked about in free exercise, you find a different way in. Okay? The best way to do it nowadays seems to be through free speech and equal access. So for instance, private speech in support of religion is protected by the free speech and free exercise clauses. So take a case like Widmar v. Vincent. University of Missouri, Kansas City bars a Christian student group named Cornerstone from using facilities because the students wish to engage in religious worship and expression. They said it's a violation of the Establishment Clause to let you have a Christian club. Well, instead of arguing about the Establishment Clause, the winning argument was, no, this is about free speech in a public forum. Okay, take it away from the Establishment Clause because the Establishment Clause is unstable at best. Now, bringing us up to current events, that's all we can say really about the Establishment Clause in this very, very limited time, is that it is, as Kennedy says, I think in practice, unworkable. Yes, 5 minutes. Okay, we'll do our best to get to the questions that were asked before. So just to review very, very briefly, we saw that in Sherbert, the court instituted the strict scrutiny test. Employment v. Smith knocked it down. Congress was unhappy and they put it back. Bernie v. Flores limited it to federal laws, and now states are battling over whether or not they should pass their own versions of RFRA. Why not? What are the arguments that you're reading in the news about why people are saying you should or should not pass a state RFRA? Well, people claim that it will lead every person to become a law unto themselves and create chaos. Does that sound familiar? It should. That's what the court said in Smith, and Congress said, no, we don't buy it. So Congress actually rejected that very argument in 1993. Now think about it. Strict scrutiny was the law from 63 to 90, and federal law again from 93 until now, and the floodgates haven't opened. Strict scrutiny is actually a test that does very, very well. You don't automatically get an exemption. You can't just become a law unto themselves. If you are, in fact, sincerely burdened, and there's no other way, then maybe you'll get an exemption. Well, people say, won't RFRA lead to a parade of horribles? And they list things like EMTs denying services to LGBT people, or religious people being allowed to abuse their children in the name of religion. Won't that happen if we allow people to get exemptions? The answer is no, of course not. We said there are some trump cards that always win and always have won. Any judge who allows child abuse because of RFRA should be taken off the bench, period. There's no question about that. Of course RFRA wouldn't allow you to hurt other people or to deny medical services in any instance. Why are RFRAs important? In general, it's a good thing for society to shape its laws so that people can live in accordance with their sincerely held religious obligations. As Americans, we've always valued that freedom and expression of religion. And sometimes a law seems to impose only a small burden on some people, but in practice it severely burdens certain people. And if there's no compelling governmental interest in enforcing that law for that particular person, it makes sense, if no one else is harmed at least, that religion should be granted an exemption. Okay. The crux of the debate then is really completely narrow. It's not really about the benefits of religion. Religious exemptions shouldn't be allowed to harm others, right? We said you can't shift the burden to an innocent third party. Obviously, you can't harm your child in the name of religion. The question is, and this is the entire debate is really about, how to define harm, okay? And harm particularly in same-sex marriage cases or in similarly situated cases. Most courts nowadays, I would assume, would consider discrimination harmful. There's a compelling governmental interest to prevent discrimination. And so the question really that we're talking about at the crux of all the RFRA debates is the definition of harmful and whether or not there should be one line added saying that discrimination is harmful. It's important is not to cast it in absolute terms and say that people who don't want RFRAs hate religion. Not all the people who don't want RFRAs hate religion. They're worried about a particular aspect of it. Where does that leave us? Okay, so things are, I said, a bit of a mess. Establishment Clause jurisprudence is a half-dead monster, or at best, it's all over the place. Free exercise is scattered state by state. Is there anything that we can reasonably predict is going to happen in the near future? And I'll say one thing that I think we can reasonably predict is revisiting the idea of polygamy. And this is why polygamy is not like burning somebody on a pyre. Jack, Jill, and Jennifer want to be polygamously married in their church. They're each single, healthy, heterosexual, in their mid-20s. They're each Ivy educated, trained in clinical psychology, independently wealthy, and eager to enter into a lifelong covenant with the others. When the case comes, it will be a test case. They will find the perfect plaintiffs to do it. They will look something like this. They marry in accordance with their church rituals. They have several children together, occupy a huge house in the middle of town. They are respected local leaders. A young state attorney, eager to curry favor with state conservatives, prosecutes the parties for violating state polygamy laws that have been on the books since the founding, or at least since Reynolds. A state welfare agency seizes their children while the case is pending. Jack, Jill, and Jennifer claim constitutional rights to sexual privacy, equal protection, parental autonomy, and here we are, religious liberty. What rationale for prosecuting polygamy would be so compelling that the state would win its case? I can't think of any. It's different because nobody's getting harmed here. You can certainly argue in cases where people are getting harmed by polygamy or forced into it that it's like burning somebody on a pyre. But they're all making this choice very consciously, very openly. Maybe they have a prenup beforehand, right? A polygamous prenup, delineating all the rights and privileges underneath it. Now, you laugh, but there are over 500,000 people in the United States living in polyamorous relationships, committed relationships. And by the way, the most common form is two women and one man, almost two-thirds, and 69% of them have said that they want the right to marry. So this case is coming, and when the court revisits Reynolds and looks at the arguments that it used to prohibit polygamy, those arguments, especially in light of recent decisions, are not going to work. And so I'll leave you with this one thought, which is one thing you can predict based on recent history and based on what we've done, is that polygamy will come back. And the question is, can you think of a rationale for why it might fail?
Well, just what they're arguing is that it can harm the children. But
multiple studies, at least 11 that I know of in the last 15 years, have said that there's no harm to children. I'm not arguing for it either. I'm just
just what they're arguing, you know, with marriage of the female generally at a young age, etc.
Sure. Non-consensual polygamy, absolutely forbidden, but it's still forbidden. It's always been forbidden. We're talking about post-same-sex, consensual, adult, egalitarian, plural marriage. Yeah.
This is an argument that Jonathan Roach made.
Sure, but homosexual couples can marry also. They can marry people they don't want to marry. And polygamists respond by saying, we can marry a person, but we want to marry people.
I'm just saying that's one
argument. Sure, yeah. Anyone else? Yeah. Maybe it is a religion. A lot of religions have a history of polygamy. Judaism, Islam, Mormonism, sorry?
Or would they say like there's no definition?
Well, when there's no definition, the court is overly generous with its definition. If you claim it's a religion, even if it's idiosyncratic, then they're probably going to give it to you, as long as it's sincerely held. Okay, so I'll leave you with that perhaps depressing idea, which is that, or if you're polygamous, it's very nice and good for you. Yeah. Sure, there are some wonderful books in the hallway that will go through everything that I said in a ton more detail. And I would highly recommend those. I would also recommend Religion, the Constitutional Experiment by John Witte. And in regards to polygamy in particular, there are a couple of books coming out in the very near future that deal specifically with the legalization of polygamy after the same-sex marriage decisions. Okay?
Enjoy. All right, please join me in thanking Dr. Goldberger. One of those books that's coming out on coming battles over polygamy is written by Professor Goldberger, another by his colleague John Witte, and they're battling it out from the same center with different views about what's likely coming with respect to that issue. So thank you all. It's time now to shuffle over to lunch, so let's move there quickly so that we can stay on schedule.
Thanks.
Sorry, what was the name of that book? It was Religion and the Constitutional Experiment?
Yeah. It made the American Constitutional Experiment.
Oh, in the American.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Quick question.
Sure.
In Kitchen, the Kitchen decision.
Which one?
The Kitchen decision here in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it the argument for religious cohabitation?
Yeah, Utah was it two years ago you're talking about?
Yeah.
That was about decriminalizing one aspect of it. It wasn't even real polygamy. It was about decriminalizing it in private.
Okay, so what was the
The crux was that you're basically allowed to do it unless you try. Thank you. Unless you try to make it marriage, and it seems odd that if you want to have as many live-in cohabitants as you want, it's fine until you try to make it permanent. And so basically said, if you don't try to get a license,
right,
it's fine.
But maybe I'm misremembering the case, but in the Utah case 2 years ago, maybe it was the Kitchen was the other one that was But the language of religious cohabitation was used mm-hmm. as an argument.
Yeah. Well, because, again, they were only getting married religiously. They weren't trying to get a state license. If they tried to get a state license, the court said it would have upheld the ban.
Okay, so that's the difference that
yeah.
you would say is what this
mm-hmm.
is. Okay, gotcha.
Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Someone from Emory here. That
thank you.
Center is there is really well respected.
Oh yeah, I appreciate it.
We have a son who graduated from Emory Law School.
Oh really?
First word from Professor Witte.
Yeah, he's. I mean, Witte is an unbelievable star. We're very lucky to have him.
Oh, lucky to have you too.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Outstanding.
Oh, thank you very much. Kind of a lot to try and cover in an hour, but appreciate it. Thank
do
you.
Do we get the audio of your?
I think so. I signed something saying that they're going to put the audio up online.
Okay, that's
so.
Right.
I think so.
What was the name of that book again? Constitution.
Religion and the American Constitutional Experiment.
What is it?
Religion and the American Constitutional Experiment.
Oh, religion. And who is the author?
John Witte.
So you recommend that?
Highly. It's the course that's the book that I use in my course. And it's written for a lay person or for a non-specialist lawyer. So it gets a real...
John
Witte. John Witte, Jr. Yeah.
Religion and the...
American Constitutional Experiment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to follow up on your response to the Jonathan Roche thing. What would be the difference between that fundamental access question where LGBT folks didn't have access to marriage at all in the left kind of view, you know, consensual adult loving couples, whereas polygamists do, they just can't access it with multiple people.
So the question comes down to people are framing it as polygamists are just, to put it bluntly, sex hungry and want to just marry more people and live together. But the strong response is that it's actually not, and these are family systems, and that if you look at how they raise, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, and they use that and say, actually, our families are better because our children have wonderful role models. They make it about the family versus opposed to about the cohabitation. So it depends how you frame it. And the left, the difference they do is try to frame it as this is a loving institution. Marriage has always been about two people. And the response is, no, it hasn't. The idea of two people is actually much newer than polygamy. Polygamy has been around for thousands of years.
Yeah.
History of the world, most have been polygamous. And so...
Okay. You know, the irony is, just before I go, is mm-hmm. so Jonathan wrote this article
yep.
a load ago about how they're saying how they're all different. And like... most of his arguments, except that last one, were basically everything that conservatives have been saying about gay marriage, you know, history, biology,
mm-hmm, yeah.
social science, and it was funny that it was just amazing that in the wake of that, it's being swept.
Here's the truth: if they want to make it, other countries have already started decriminalizing polygamy, and nothing happens because guess what? Most people don't want to be polygamously married, and the few who do already are living polygamously, and it turns out that the tax stuff is not that hard to work out. It's really not that difficult. There are basically 11,000 statutes, but all of them are things like he, she, he, and you can easily regard a bunch of principles and change them into first in, first out with opt-out conditions or prenup. It's really